Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map food editor Eric Sandler. Today on the show, we'll talk about some news in the world of Houston restaurants, as well as our meal at a Houston restaurant you may want to try. To do that, I am joined by my co-host this week. She is the catering and events director for Local Foods Group. Chelsea Thomas, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Good. So happy to be back. What an exciting time.
Yes, you picked a good week to make a triumphant return as a co-host. And with that, let us dive right into the news of the week. Topic number one, no bigger news than the results of Houston Chefs at the James Beard Awards. The city took home two awards. Let us give the winners their flowers. First up is Adrian Torres of Maximo, who won Emerging Chef. Next up are the newest recipients of the Best Chef Texas Award. They are Evelyn Garcia and Henry Liu from June. This is the part where I toot my own horn and note that all three of those people have been on the podcast.
Yeah.
Evelyn's been on multiple times. We had Adrian on as part of his Star Chef's victory. So, you know, if you're a regular listener, then you're familiar with these people because we've talked about both June and Maximo quite a bit. I will say Houston is on a bit of a run in the Best Chef Texas category. We have gone back to back. Thomas Billy of Belly of the Beast obviously won last year, and Chef Benchawan Jabthong Painter of Street to Kitchen won in 2023. Chelsea, I want to talk about the individual chefs, but just big picture. You know, you have worked at some of the best restaurants in Houston. You've worked at restaurants that have been nominated for James Beard Awards. What do these wins mean for Houston and our culinary community?
Finally, the world is waking up. I mean, hello. Houston has been a major food city for as long as I've been alive. I mean, I think that people think we're just sort of like trotting out our best here. The food here is that good. Every single restaurant, you know, like we have over 10, 12, 15,000 restaurants in Houston, and so many of them are excellent. And I'm just so glad that the chefs here who work so incredibly hard are getting their recognition, because the industry here is so strong. It's so supportive of one another. And I can't even begin to express how excited I am for Houston getting this recognition, because really the chefs here deserve so much.
Well, and you know, this goes back to my very first days as a food writer. When I was interviewing in 2012 for the Eater job, I said, look, you think that Austin is the best food city in Texas, because this was to the New Yorkers that were hiring me, right? You think Austin's the best food city in Texas because of Franklin Barbecue. And at that time, that was right when Paul Key had just won Top Chef. So right. Austin was getting just a ton of national attention. Food trucks, South by Southwest, all that stuff. And I said, look, if you hire me, I will demonstrate why Houston is the best food city in Texas. So we in Houston have known this for a very long time, but it finally does feel like the rest of the world, or at least the rest of the country, is kind of waking up to this and giving us our flowers, as it were. And do I think, like, for example, for Evelyn and Henry, like, do I think it helps that they were both on Top Chef? Yes, of course I do, right? Like, those are the kind of opportunities that help you raise your national profile and compel people to try your restaurants or go to food festivals or whatever it is that they need to do so that they can, you know, vote for you, you know, this body of media members, full disclosure, including myself. Now that the process is over, I can acknowledge that I am one of a very large body that participates in this process. But those are the things you kind of have to do. And I will say, I thought based on like who votes and how the voting goes down, I thought, and I said it at the time, I thought Adrian had no shot. And so mea maxima culpa for ever doubting Adrian Torres, because Bailey Sullivan, who works at Monteverde with Sarah Grunenberg, Sarah was on Top Chef, Bailey was a finalist on Top Chef. That restaurant's in the Michelin Guide. It's one of the very best restaurants in Chicago, which is a major tourist destination. I thought she had a great shot. And then EJ Lagasse, son of Emeril Lagasse, you know, food world legend in New Orleans, two Michelin stars for Emeril's. I thought he was the favorite. And indeed, you clued me into this. Kalshi was taking action on Emerging Chef, and EJ Lagasse and Bailey were the two favorites. So I thought, the wisdom of the crowds, I thought, well, surely Adrian has no shot. But, you know, here we are. So I guess, Chelsea, I've talked long enough. Let me throw it to you. Say something nice about Evelyn and Henry and why you think kind of they set themselves apart over very strong competition to win this award.
Well, speaking as someone who also used to work as a food critic for New Yorkers that didn't understand Houston at all, back when I was still doing that job, I went to June for the opening and I was absolutely blown away by that restaurant. I mean, it was one of the top restaurants in when I was working for the Infatuation in our top 25 guide. I think it's still rated on the Infatuation as a 9.6 with my review. I was obsessed with June from the start. I just thought it was so thoughtful, so intentional. The food is colorful and fun, but it didn't feel like it was trying to be this like menu of buzzwords meant to impress people. It felt really natural and genuine and something that, you know, Evelyn and Henry had made before, because I'd eaten Evelyn's food before when she was doing the Peruvian pop-up. And I think she is just such, I mean, I've never met her personally, like in, really met her, but I can tell from the food that her and Henry make, it's so warm. It's so lovely. It's meant to really touch you and make you feel special, I think, like in a way that someone's taking care of you, you know?
Right. I mean, what I remember thinking when June first opened and I went, you know, I did what I do. I went like two or three times in the first 4 or 5 months to kind of get a feel for the place. Yeah. And what I remember thinking is that I was learning something about food and flavor and preparations and these different cuisines that they were incorporating, which is rare because you have a certain idea about how dishes are prepared and what they're going to taste like. And this was really different than anything that I could recall having had at any other Houston restaurant. And I think that's still true, right? I think that what June is doing is special and very specific to their backgrounds. And so, yes, from a food perspective, I think June has been exceptional. And then on top of that, right, you get this whole second layer where they started this daytime concept third place, and now it's an incubator for all of these other small businesses, these pop-ups, these various chefs, these up-and-coming chefs or that want to get their name out there, or established chefs who want to do something different, right? Like when I've been to third place for Cheesesteaks by Don Burrell and Hot Dogs by Tristan Epps, you know, Rafi Nasser, who's a contributor to this show. You know, he does Lebanese food at Craft Pita, his restaurant, but his mother's Peruvian and he's very in touch with his Peruvian heritage. So he's been doing a Peruvian pop-up every now and then at third place that could be the basis for another restaurant, a whole other business, a whole other concept. So, you know, the third place has been this incredible incubator fostering the next generation of culinary talent, because for the James Beard Awards, it's not just about serving a great meal. It's about being a member of the community and contributing to the betterment of society. And they've really done that. And they deserve a lot of credit for that. And more than anything, that's what I suspect kind of pushed them over the top for Best Chef Texas.
And I think also they've done it in a way that does not feel contrived. It doesn't feel forced, like they're trying to do this like Emmy stunt kind of stunt PR, get this thing going. Like, these are genuinely people who are their friends. These are genuinely people who they like their food. They support their businesses because I'm sure they remember what it was like to be pop-up chefs and like kind of trying to find their home as well. So like for them, this is a natural progression of their successful business where they are welcoming people in from the start of their business with the food, but then also continuing that with the community. And I mean, not a week goes by where I don't see something amazing coming out of third place. And I think that they have done it in a way that feels so genuine to who they are as people. And I'm sure that is really where that distinction lies, because it's not something that they're doing to be like, hey, look at us, we're successful chefs. They're doing it in a way to be like, these are our friends, you know, like we love it here.
Right. And I think the other thing is, you know, I've always sort of talked about this like in the Goodfellas sense, right? Mm-hmm. Winning a James Beard Award makes you a made man in the food world. And it opens you up to doing events in other cities, other food festivals, maybe a cookbook. The sky's really the limit. And I saw, you know, Thomas Billy kind of commenting on that on Instagram after the ceremony, because he was there cooking, right? As a winner, yeah. He got to go back and cook for all the nominees and all the media members and everyone who was at the ceremony this year. So it really does. It gives you like a level of credibility and opens up so many opportunities. And so I wouldn't be surprised if in another year or two that Evelyn and Henry are doing another restaurant, maybe in the Heights, maybe in another part of the city. But June is so creative and they can really do whatever they want within the boundaries of new Asian American food. Like it's a really big sandbox to play in, but yeah. I'm sure that they have other things that they want to do, and it will be easier to do those things now that they have won this award.
Yeah. I think that Houston would have always supported them, whatever, you know, new venture they wanted to start doing, because since June has been open, I think collectively people have been obsessed with it. And now that they're branching out and giving all of these other chefs and all of these other talented people either new ways to express themselves or a place to be themselves, I think like that following will only continue, because it's just such a really lovely thing to be a part of. And I mean, you get to eat absolutely incredible food while you do it. So why not, you know? But, and I think while the James Beard Award does legitimize you, I think nationally and maybe a little bit outside of nationally, I think really what it is for me is these awards just are like a feather in the cap of something we already know as Houstonians about these chefs. Like we already know they're worthy of these awards. We already know how amazing that they are. And I think that this is just something to be like, yes, you know, a little bit of like a little bit of credibility, although they were already there, you know? So I'm really happy for Evelyn and Henry. I think it's well-deserved.
Thank you so much. I mean, where do we even begin? Henry likes to joke that we opened June because it was always my dream. And I can tell you, since I was a little girl, it really always have been my dream. But my dream was not just to open a restaurant, to cook food, to be creative, to enjoy. But it really has turned into a space of not creativity for ourselves, but for our team. Oh my God, guys, I bet you guys are losing it right now. A space to showcase our city. Houston, I love you so, so much. Our amazing city is made from creatives, from first generations like we are. It is a city of dreams and hopes. And what has taught me anything with June is that there's room for everyone, that there's a space to tell our story, that we are, that it's meant to be heard, and that there's a reason why we're here. Thank you so much. I don't know if anyone wants to say anything.
I'm sorry, I'm so unwell right now.
Oh, and I want to thank my mom and dad, of course.
I want to thank our team that supported us through this whole journey. I was like, we wouldn't be where we are without them. I want to thank our immigrant parents that lived the American dream and really put us where we are today. I was like, we have no investors, and they invested so much in us and what we believed in, and everything that we are today is because of them. Yes. Oh, God. And just thank you, James Beard, for this moment and for every future thing that's going to come.
After this, this is just the beginning. And honestly, I want to thank you, Henry, for believing in me and us and knowing that we can do this, because it's freaking hard. But we're so happy we get to do it every day. Thank you. Thank you so much.
And I'm so glad to see that award keeps going to Houstonians.
Yeah, I mean, the other Texans on this, they don't tell you who else is on the committee. So it's not like you can conspire, but mm-hmm. I do have this feeling like all of the media members from Austin and San Antonio and Dallas are going to be like, there is no fucking way I'm voting for another Houston, like for 5 years. There's not going to be another, like, we'll see. But, you know, I just have this feeling.
Houston, Texas, big dog, good luck. You know, yeah. That's what I have to say.
All right. Let's talk about Adrian Torres, who obviously is your colleague. Maximo is a local foods group restaurant. You have been with the company basically for all of Maximo's run, I think. So,
almost,
you know,
yeah.
It was a surprise, right? Because they opened Maximo originally with a different chef and a more casual concept. And then Benji Levitt, the owner of Local Foods Group, and Seth Siegel Gardner, the culinary director for Local Foods Group, kind of got to know Adrian and basically decided, like, this kid is too talented. We need to flip this. We need to go more upscale. It makes sense in West U. We're going to give this then 26-year-old, now 27-year-old, the opportunity to really showcase what he can do. And they really doubled down on it with this $45 5-course tasting menu that is kind of the signature thing to get at Maximo. And of course, it's very affordable. $45 is a great deal. But also, it's not like such an overwhelming amount of food that you can't supplement. So if you see the 5 courses and you're like, cool, you can throw an extra appetizer, an extra entree, or both on there if you're a group of 2, 3, 4 people. And so you get kind of the tasty menu, but also like you get to kind of explore a little bit. It's such a smart idea, and it's made that restaurant so approachable. And of course, it's, you know, like a social media obsession. Sean the Food Chief has posted about it a bunch. I know other creators in Houston have posted about it quite a bunch. But again, like I'm rattling on. You actually work with him. So tell the audience something we don't know or something that would surprise us. What's it like to work with Adrian day in and day out?
Adrian's so sweet. I mean, there's not like a lot to say that I think is surprising. The way that he presents himself, I think, in all of the videos he makes and all the things he's talking about is really how he is. I mean, he's an incredibly hard worker. He's so intentional about everything that happens at Maximo. He really thinks through all of the details of how he wants his food to come out, how he wants it to look, how he wants it to be represented. And I think in a way that is, it's not in a way to like control things. It's a way to be like, this is special. You know, this is important. And I think he really does a good job of translating that in everything that he does. And yes, he's a young child, Adrian. He's only 27. Yeah.
Gen Z all up in just, this, you know.
I know. Yeah, he is young, but he works so hard. And I think the one thing I always love to tell people about Adrian is that he doesn't drink, but he loves brisk iced tea with lemon. That's like his favorite thing. So this year for Christmas, I got him a brisk iced tea with lemon subscription for the restaurant. So there's like a 12 pack of 12 or 20, I can't remember, that so shows up the restaurant every month for that's my Christmas gift.
Oh, that's so funny.
And he's like, please send more. What's, you know, but I can't, I mean, I literally, what a big moment. Honestly, I can't even, it's hard to even say anything because I was watching the Beard Awards and I think I was getting into it. And actually you texted me to be like, oh my God. And I was like, wait, hold on. I'm getting into it. And I luckily got his whole speech live and I'm just sobbing. Especially when he talked about his fiance Paloma, who has been like his biggest champion this whole time. I mean, she shows up at every single event. She works every single thing with him that she can. She's such an amazing partner to him. And I was so glad that she got to experience that moment with him. And his speech was so beautiful.
Shortly after my parents immigrated from San Luis Potosí, Mexico to the United States, my mom said to me, yeah, let's go, San Luis Potosí. We are here. My mom sat my sister and I and had a conversation with us that I will never forget. She said, never tell anyone about your legal status. Never talk about our immigration journey. For a long time, fear was our story. Today, standing on this stage, I want to say something that I never thought my younger self would have the opportunity to say. I am proud to be the son of immigrants. I am proud to be an immigrant. I am proud to be a DACA recipient. Thank you. This week, while many of us flew to Chicago, my family and I drove across the country to be here. Not because we wanted to take a road trip, but because that's the reality that so many immigrant families still live with. Even in moments of celebration, there are reminders that our journey is different. But tonight, I refuse to let fear be the headline. Tonight, the headline is that a brown kid from the north side, raised by parents who sacrificed everything for the chance at a better life, is standing on this stage accepting one of the highest honors in this industry. Mamá y papá, gracias por dejar su tierra para darle a su familia una oportunidad. Nunca podré pagar ese sacrificio, pero espero que momentos como este les recuerden que todo valió la pena. Palomita, gracias por siempre ser la luz en mi camino. Te amo con todo mi corazón. Thank you to everyone back home that's made this possible. Gracias a mi familia de Máximo, Víctor, Chucky, Edgar, Ángel, Awi, Chino, Félix, Geno, Oscar, Chef Seth. Este reconocimiento lleva mi nombre, pero pertenece a todos nosotros. Los quiero un chingo. And to our incredible front of house team, thank you for making us look good every single day. Lastly, I am excited to bring this award back to the city. Desde el norte de Houston para el mundo. Gracias.
He really has worked so hard. I mean, I remember when I dined at Maximo the first time, I was already working at the company. And I ate dinner there and I was just like, wow, this is really good. And I had the tasting menu before we put that out. Like we were kind of, he was rolling it out to all the chefs, some of the management, we were all trying it. And so I sat down and I tried it by myself at the bar and I ate through it. And I think in my head, I was like, oh, really freaking good. What the hell? You know, like.
Right. And only $45, like such a deal.
Right. And at the time, I mean, it had that magical cornbread with the mole and the caviar and the chicatana butter. I mean, it was great. And I had the same feeling as I did with some other restaurants I've been to, namely when you and I dined at Basso. I think we had a similar discussion where we were like, all the pieces are here, right? Everything that could make this unbelievably amazing, or it's all here. It just needs to be rearranged just a little bit for it to be absolutely magical. And I think about 5 or 6 months ago, Adrian hit that. He hit that like magic sweet spot with enough time of like changing over the chef's tasting, changing over things seasonally, where it just all really came together. And the last time I had dinner there, I was with my mom and my family and everyone was like, whoa, what is this place? You know? And I went to Adrian and I was like, it's there. It's so there. Like everything that you want it to be, it's just so refined. All the details were tweaked. It was one of the best meals I've had at Maximo ever. And everyone I talked to is obsessed with that place. They're like, oh my God, we had no idea. And I'm like, yeah, it's amazing, you know? And I think that they hear $45 tasting menu, which is exciting. It is a great deal. But I think when they get there, they're like, you're getting so much more than $45. You really are getting an absolutely amazing experience. And like, we truly couldn't be more proud of Adrian. I think everything he does for the restaurant, for Maximo, for the people that work there, for his family, you know? The Lado Norte al Mundo, like he said in his speech, I mean, he's just a kid from the north side. And we're so, I could go on and on about how proud we are of him. And I know Seth is like beyond proud, like a dad proud of
well,
him.
Well, right. And Seth has been through this process. I mean, Seth had the bad luck of operating the Pass and Provisions before Texas was its own region in the James Beard Awards, right? Like it was still
right.
Southwest. And he was also in the mix with Chris Shepherd and Justin Yu and Hugo Ortega, who all won, you know, within a couple mm-hmm. of years of each other. And so it was going to be really hard for another Houston chef to win, even though what Seth and Terrence were doing at the Pass and Provisions was so impressive.
Yeah.
It just never quite worked out. So to have Adrian get to this point, again, a complete surprise to me, but delighted, right? Because what he's doing is so is so delicious. And, you know, you mentioned his speech. I've had brief conversations with him, certainly, but I never expected him to be that fiery and passionate and political, frankly, about his status as a DACA recipient and the reason that he drove to the ceremony rather than flew to the ceremony is related to him and his family's immigration status. And to just stand up there and say, I'm proud to be a DACA recipient. This is, you know, I'm an immigrant. My family are immigrants. I mean, it was such a special night. And this industry really runs on immigrant labor. I mean, you know, Anthony Bourdain talked about it for years and years. I'm not breaking any new ground with that observation. So, you know, the crowd loved it because they know that restaurants, especially more than a lot of other industries, provide opportunity for immigrants like Adrian to have a life for them, you know, to build a life in America and realize the American dream. I mean, even thinking about Hugo Ortega, who came to this country without papers or, you know, however, whatever euphemism you want to use, and then worked really hard and rose through the ranks and married Tracy and became a citizen. And now he's like one of the most successful restaurateurs in Houston. So like Adrian is now on that same path, and it's just, it's incredible. And it was such an emotional speech, and it was so good to see him up there in his cowboy hat and his sport coat, representing Texas, representing Houston. It was a very special moment. And I think one that people will remember for a long time.
I think so. I mean, he is, to me, Adrian is the American dream. I mean, he has worked so hard for this. He's worked so hard for this alongside his family, alongside his friends, you know, like he deserves all of this. And he has really, I think he has always been open about his immigration status. I mean, I know that we've had some other publications that have talked about it, and that's been something he very personally believes in, you know? And I think him getting up there and being so passionate about it and so brave about it it had to have been really inspiring to a group of people that work with, you know, work with people in the kitchens, know what that situation is like. Like they are fully aware of that, and also and so in love with and dependent on their team, right? And their team means everything. So I think for someone who's the head of the kitchen to stand up there and be just like their team members, it must mean so much, you know, or like some of their team members, it must be so much. And I think that him winning hopefully changes some things, especially for DACA recipients who were children. I mean, they shouldn't be in this legal limbo because has nothing to do with them. Like they were innocent kids, you know? So they should have the right to be here because they've been here their whole lives, you know? And they are Americans, frankly. So I think that we couldn't be more proud of him for his hard work, for his beliefs, for his, you know, firmness in who he is and where he's from and what he represents and what he wants to deliver as his story, not only of himself and of food. I mean, we couldn't be happier for Adrian.
All right. That seems like a good place to wrap this up. Let's move on. Just briefly, I want to do topic number two, because we have a restaurant we're really excited to talk about. But I do want to note that Aga's To Go opens this Wednesday, June 24th, out in Katy. You know, we know Aga's. It's this massive, 15, 16,000 square foot restaurant in a shopping center in Southwest Houston. It is a staple of the South Asian community. It was the Houston Chronicle's number one restaurant in Houston in 2025 on their top 100. We've nominated it for, Culture Map has nominated it for Neighborhood Restaurant in the Tastemaker Awards a few times. And my understanding is that it's one of the busiest Uber Eats restaurants in the country. So what do you think about Aga's? What do you think about opening a to-go location as a way to kind of expand the brand without committing maybe to the expense of a full-service sit-down location?
Well, I think it's probably really hard to replicate the experience you get at Aga's, right? I mean, even if you were to open a new restaurant, it's never going to be the same as the original. It's never going to have the same magic. It's a different staff. It's new people, blah, 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 blah. It becomes its own entity, right? And I think Aga's wants, maybe there's a part of them that wants to preserve that experience that you get at the original restaurant, which I understand very much. But if they are that busy with to-go food, the kitchen is probably really tired. So I'm sure that they're like, hey, let's open a to-go catering. We can just shift all of our catering over here, all of our to-go over here, just have a crew dedicated to that, like a commissary kitchen almost. And then that way our kitchen, which is already busy and stressed serving this, you know, 15,000 square foot restaurant, like, I feel like that's an amazing thing to do for your staff, because you're like, okay, hey, y'all are going to focus on this. Y'all are going to focus on this, divide and conquer kind of situation. And I mean, I'm sure people want to take the experience of Aga's home and share it with their family if they have like a bigger party or something like that, or if they just want one delicious dish, you know?
Right. We should say Indian cuisine, Pakistani cuisine, all those curries, the goat chops, mm-hmm. the rice dishes, the biryani, the naan, all that, it travels really well.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's not like Neapolitan pizza or Texas barbecue, right? You can mm-hmm. you can take it to go and take it home, and it'll be maybe an A- or a B+ version of itself compared to what you get in a restaurant. Whereas some cuisines, it's like you shouldn't do it. Like, people yeah. do it, but people take all kinds of things to go, but you shouldn't.
As someone who thinks about events and catering all the time, I mean, this is amazing for catering. Like, this is an amazing business move to, like, have your own separate kitchen to be like, hey, we need to prep, you know, 100 biryanis. We're going to do it here. We're not going to take space in our regular restaurant.
Right. We have a wedding for 1,000 people.
Yeah.
We got to crank out all the, you know, karahi we can.
Yeah. And then you can have separate orders. You can have separate P&Ls, separate all that stuff for that business versus the other business. And that way you keep your costs down. You understand where the money is going. I mean, business-wise, it just makes sense because you're kind of separating all of that out. And then you can really understand your margins on things. But I think also from the guest perspective, like, you're not competing with service at the restaurant. You're not, you know, you have your own supplies, your own place to go, your own people to focus on. And they're not getting pulled into what's happening at the restaurant, which I think is great for the client.
Well, right. And if you're Katy or Richmond resident, mm-hmm. Cypress even, it's a much shorter drive, right? If you want to pick up, if you want to get delivery, if you want to do whatever, you know, the food will come to you hotter, faster, fresher. And that's all to the good.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's a large community of people in those neighborhoods that are also Pakistani, that are also South Asian, that want that food probably at home for their families, and or just want it because they want to have, you know, a curry that day or whatever. But, you know, it's hard to get over to Aga's all the time from, as someone who lives in Cyprus, that's a trek. That's a long way to go. So.
Well, and I like that it's like 4,800 square feet, which is bigger than most whole mm-hmm. restaurants that serve people. I mean, if you think about a place like Nancy's Hustle or Nobie's or some of these other like small independent June, even, you know, some of these small independently owned places, Basso, that we love, like 4,800 square feet is bigger than their whole restaurant, dining room, back of the house, front of the house, whatever. That's how much space Aga's needs just for to go, just for catering, just to serve the demand. So it's an incredible business right up there with other kind of quirky Houston one-offs, right? Like Taste of Texas comes to mind, mm-hmm. the original Ninfa's, you know, these like,
yeah.
big restaurants that are locally owned, that have a place in the community, that just serve a ton of people every day. And apparently this is the first of at least one or two more that they want to do, these to-go-only locations. I think they're looking at a location in spring. I wouldn't be surprised if they, you know, wind up, I hard to imagine that they'd come inside the loop. I just think the expense would probably be too great, but
yeah,
you know, they could, but certainly one for spring in the Woodlands.
I think even over in the Pearland area would probably be something they could do.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, having these satellite locations that are like catering and to-go focused, like hitting all, especially in the Woodlands, hitting all those businesses out there, doing business catering, office catering, blah, blah, blah. I mean, yeah, I think it's a smart move. I think it's the way to go. I think because personally for me, I love the experience of the original restaurant and the magic you get at the small, at like, quote unquote, small concept, right? Like you get that initial energy from that place and the experience that they've always been providing, which I think is really wonderful, important. And that is not always easily replicated, you know, but a lot of people want that experience so specifically at the restaurant that's not replicatable, or they want it at home. They want to be able to be like, we just want a party. Can we get catering? You know? And that's right. Something I think a lot of people
I want to drink wine with my biryani. Good luck doing that at the original location. But if you take it home, exactly. You're all good.
Yeah. And I think also people, like, there's a lot of people that are moving toward that experience where like their house is a place that they want to entertain, but maybe they don't necessarily want to cook, or they don't want to hire someone to come and cook, and being able to have like some really incredible food catered, like, why not, you know?
Absolutely. All right, Chelsea, I'm going to say that does it for the news of the week. We'll be right back with our restaurant of the week. Stick around. Chelsea, for our restaurant of the week, I want to talk to you about Osteria Mercado. This is a 25-seat restaurant in West U. It is affiliated with Mercado & Company, which is like a gourmet grocer, Italian grocer, wine shop, sitch, right around the corner from Maximo, actually. Mm-hmm. Right in the heart of West U, right near West U City Hall. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm just going to turn you loose and let you go. I mean, talk a little bit about kind of your, I want to talk about the food, but just talk about your kind of first impressions of the space, like when you walked in and what sort of caught your eye.
Yeah. Osteria Di Mercato, I think. I think it's lovely. It's so tiny. It's a little postage stamp. You know, you walk in, there's a tiny little bar, there's a couple tables. Mostly, I think what you're struck by is that there's just shelves that go around the entire little, you know, rectangular restaurant of wine. Just you're seated basically like inside of a wine shelf in some of the tables, which kind of reminds me a lot of Helen's Greek food and wine. You kind of pass through that wine shelf when you're there. And or when you were there. And so it's a lot like that, but I think it's bright in there. It's kind of modern, very green, very, I don't know. It just feels cozy, but not too dark. Still feels, you know, approachable. And like just a, this is going to sound not nice, but I mean it in the nicest way. A regular restaurant. It's not trying to be ultra luxe. It's not trying to be ultra fancy. It's not trying to be super casual. It's just like it presents in a really nice kind of modern but still warm way, which I like.
Yeah, it's very much felt like a neighborhood restaurant. You know, we're sitting there having dinner. People walked in. There's people drinking wine next door in the grocery store. They'd walk into the dining room to use the restroom or to check on something or whatever. And, oh, you're here tonight. Like, how's it going? Mm-hmm. You know, there were just those kind of neighbors meeting neighbors. You see it at the place that comes to mind a lot is Brasserie 19, right? Like you see that at, because the River Oaks crowd just loves that restaurant and they all go there and they all know each other and it promotes those kind of interactions. I'm with you. There's something really, you know, it's just this kind of narrow, longish room. And so it feels very intimate and you're kind of shoulder to shoulder with the table next to you. I mean, we got into a little bit of a conversation with the two women dining next to us because it turns out that you knew someone, right? Like
yes,
one of your regulars from Maximo was at Osteria Mercado, and she leans mm-hmm. over to me and she goes, "It's the best Italian restaurant in Houston. Don't tell Chelsea I said so because of Milton's." And I'm like, "No, Milton's is a very different style of Italian food,
yes,
right? That's Italian American. This is regional Italian cooking, and it really just follows that like." Kind of Italian sensibility, simple dishes, fresh ingredients, seasonal ingredients, kind of let the food speak for itself, right? Take you know, like Roberto Grande used to say, right? Take good ingredients and don't mess them up. And I feel like that's a lot of what's happening at Osteria di Mercato. So I don't know, talk about maybe one or two of your favorite dishes from what we ate.
Well, this dish we received, we did not order, was the foie gras torchon with the peach sauce with it. I'm not a foie gras person, judge me if you want, but I'm not really into it. I like it every now and then as, you know, I'm good with pate sometimes in my banh mi. I can do it every now and then, but I'm never going to order it. It's just not something I gravitate to. So when it showed up, I was like, oh, okay, you know, I'll try this. It's probably not going to be what I like. I loved it. It was so good. It was somehow really light, very delicate.
Right. It was really creamy. It didn't have any of that metallic flavor that I think of as being part of foie gras.
No, it was sweet, kind of sweet, delicate, very creamy. It was rich, but not in a way that made all your taste buds feel heavy, right? It was somehow still very, it was almost like I don't know. I don't want to compare it to a dessert because it's not that sweet, but to me, it just didn't give me, there was nothing about it that gave me the parts of the flavor of foie gras that I'm not as keen on. And I was so surprised by it. And I think that was really what started, the second we tried that, my little, you know, antenna, as it were, went up.
You're like,
I was like, there's something happening here.
We might be at a special restaurant, actually.
We might be. Yeah. I was like, oh, interesting. This might be very surprising.
You know, the other one that really struck me early in the meal was that tuna crudo, where it's just these kind of thinly sliced pieces of good quality tuna with the sliced apple, and then the broth had apple and vinegar, and so it's meaty and tart, and it's not like a ceviche necessarily, because I think the tuna was still raw. It wasn't that the tuna was marinated or cooked in the, you know, in the acid or whatever. It was just these ingredients that really played so nicely together. And arancini, it feels like arancini are having a moment. I think we, you know, Rafi and I talked about the arancini at Kirkwood last week, and, you know, I had them at Tiny Champions recently. And so, you know, here they are at Osteria Mercato, and give me all the fried rice balls, right? These have a little saffron in them, right? For that kind of, you know, spice component. They have this really nice bright salsa verde with them. I mean, just a classic dish, but done really well. And I think that is kind of typical of what they're trying to do here at Osteria di Mercato. All right, talk about the pastas, because we can't do this without talking about the pastas.
Well, I think to go off of what you said about the tuna, our server told us when we ordered our full meal, he was like, hey, I want to send the tuna out. He said, do you mind if I kind of come up with my own coursing for this? And you're like, yeah, we trust you. Go ahead. And I'm so glad that we trusted him, because he put that tuna and apple dish out as a palate cleanser mid-meal. And it really punched us, which I thought was so fabulous, because I think it could have come around the time the foie gras torchon came. And I think that would have gotten really lost. I feel like we would have been like, oh, lots of bright, lots of acid. Okay, blah, 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 moving on. But because he put those dishes sort of bookending some things that were really savory, you got this amazing, big hit of acid right mid-meal, right before you went into the pastas. And it cleansed your palate for the most amazing pasta experience. And I think it was just beautiful. It was beautifully done. As a former server, obsessed with coursing, I think that was just such a bright move to do. I mean, it's a little obvious, but still great, because I don't think a lot of people are really maneuvering menus in that way, in a way I would like to see. And I think the server did a really great job with that, because when that rabbit pasta came out and it just hit you with all of that earthy flavor, I mean, wow. I think it was, I couldn't have wanted a better, you know, transition into the pastas. It was just beautiful. And I think the one thing we kept commenting on with the pastas was just how how al dente they were. Like it was walking the thinnest line between al dente and undercooked. It was just such a tiny little sliver between the
right.
two.
It's and frankly, that's a dangerous game in a kitchen, especially in Houston, right? Like it's one thing in Italy or maybe in a city like New York or Chicago or San Francisco, but my general experience both personally and from talking to other people is that we don't, as a city, don't really want an actually al dente pasta. We want them to be, by the Italian standard, slightly overcooked. And so I think it takes a lot of courage and a lot of like commitment to your own standards to serve mm-hmm. pasta that al dente. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's one of the perks of being like 25 seats is that if people don't like it, then they can go somewhere else, right? Like you can be true to yourself because you're only serving 50, 60 people a night, right? You don't have to please everybody. You really just have to please the people who get it.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned the braised rabbit, the fettuccine with the morel mushrooms. I mean, oh no, I'm sorry. The morels were on a different dish. Sorry. But that braised rabbit, you know, braised meat, like kind of a wintery, like more fall type dish, but rabbit is kind of lean. And so it all kind of worked together. It was the scarpinock that did have the morels and the spinach and the smoked, this like filled pasta where I was like, okay, like we're really having a special dinner because that, you know, we had a lot of filled pastas in this town and they vary in quality and the al dente quality and the flavor of the filling and the richness of the morels. I mean, just a spectacular dish. Like when I go back and look through my, you know, favorite dishes of the month, right, for any given, you know, month and try to figure out like what were my favorite dishes of the year, I'll still be thinking about that scarpinock pasta.
I think it was all incredible. And I think you're right. I think them having a perspective about how they want to serve their food and not sort of leaning into what the expectation is, I think is really what's special, because they're like, no, this is how we serve our pasta. This is how we want you to eat it. This is how we want you to try it. And, you know, if you're not into aggressively al dente pasta and you don't get it, we're not going to change that. And I think I admire that. I think that having a perspective as a restaurant while also being open to every guest is something, because if you don't have a perspective, you don't have an opinion. If you're not putting something out, what do you do? You know, what are you really saying? So I think them having that standard, and every pasta came out perfectly like that. It was so magical. And so, I mean, from the braised rabbit to the scarpinock to the bolognese, I mean, I was like, okay, surely one will be overcooked. Surely one will be undercooked. Nope. Every single one. And I was just so delighted. I think both you and I were sitting there, and I mean, I work so much. I don't get to go to as many new restaurants or as many restaurants as like you do. We were both sitting there and we're like, this might be one of the best meals we've had all year. And I will stand by that, especially once the bistecca came out. I mean, I had to have a moment where I collected myself internally after having my first bite of that dish, which is the Koji cured hanger steak with warm au poivre for tableside. Oh, please, please. Yes.
And polenta fries. I mean, just a smart, you know, a dish that you've had a million times, steak au poivre,
that
you've had a million times before, but done expertly, right?
Just
great crust
so
on the steak.
Beautiful.
Seasoned right with so much pepper, cooked medium rare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the savoriness of that au poivre sauce, the crispy polenta sticks on the side. I mean, just expertly
gorgeous.
Done.
And gorgeous.
I eat a lot of steak. I like going to restaurants for steak. I like going to steakhouses for steak. This hanger steak and then the Wagyu Australian ribeye that I had at Street to Kitchen are like two of the best steaks I've had anywhere in Houston in the last year, including every steakhouse that I've been to, because, you know, when you have good ingredients and you just, you know, you cook in a pan or whatever you do to get the crust and get that flavor, like good is good. You know, it doesn't have to come from a steakhouse. And at a relatively affordable price, I think it's
52, I believe. 52.
Yeah, I think that's right. Relatively speaking, a lot of money for hanger steak, but like compared to like buying a ribeye or a strip or something at a steakhouse, like it's nothing. It's $20 cheaper.
I think the value here comes from the fact that the steak is cooked perfectly. It was perfect. I mean, wall-to-wall color, medium rare, very hard to achieve. Also very hard to achieve with a crust. I think I gave like a 10-minute diatribe on this while we were at dinner, just like talking about how hard this is and how annoyed I am by this one particular technical thing with cooking. And you were probably like, please shut up and eat your steak. But
like, I would never tell you to shut up and eat your steak.
But the fact that it had that wall-to-wall color and a crust, I was like, someone's been reading my diary. Someone's been listening to my dreams. Because to me, paying for a steak at a restaurant, that's a lot for me. I mean, I eat steak a lot at home. I'm lucky that I live with someone who cooks steak really well. And so going out to a restaurant and paying for steak, you kind of have to twist my arm to do it unless it's like a super special occasion and I'm going to Papa's, right? Like, I am not the person who's like, ooh, steak on the menu, I'll get that. I actively avoid getting it because I'm not really in the mood for paying for it at a restaurant, right? I don't really, there's not a lot of value there. But I think here you get the value of technical precision, which I think is really to be appreciated. And I think that's what I really loved about it, was that I saw it and I was like, great color. And then I tasted it and I was like, oh my God, it has a crust, which I think is maybe like my weird Texas brain being like, steak must have crust. So I loved it. I think as someone who enjoys steak a lot and as someone who needs that textural variability, it was...
Right, this is the reason we don't eat filet, right? We want our steak to have some texture.
Yeah.
Also, I like that you're going to make your partner listen to 45 minutes of this episode to hear you give him like a 3-second compliment.
Always. I mean, why not? You know? But like, I'm saying you don't... It's hard to go out and pay for these very expensive cuts of meat because they are so expensive. And you're like, ooh, I'll get my value somewhere else because food and going out and everything in the world is already so expensive right now. So I think the value in this comes from not only the fact that it's a really lovely cut of meat, the koji cure is lovely, but also that the technicality of how they've cooked it, just like how they did with the al dente pasta, is so present. And I think that's really the value and the part of how lovely the experience was, is you get that carried through that every single dish, that thoughtfulness and that technicality. And I think that that is so incredible, especially in what is ostensibly a little pocket neighborhood restaurant tucked into West U.
I don't want to skip dessert, right? That chocolate best cheesecake, maybe not my very favorite version of that dish. Like I think it could have had like a little more caramelization. I mean, I just think the one at Basso is so exceptional. It's really hard to, it's really hard to top that for me. But the citrus dish, you know, just sliced citrus, sea salt, olive oil, fresh whipped cream. I mean, again, like it's a little bit strange to be eating citrus in summer, right? Because this is when berries are good. This is when peaches are good. Like, you know, in a couple of months it'll be figs, right? So like, okay, like grapefruit and orange are a little bit out of place. But like when they're this good, who cares, right? Like when they're that bright and fresh and sweet and tart, who cares? Like I could eat that forever.
I think it was the same effect that tuna dish had, where it's just this beautiful like touch point in the meal where it's like, here's a bowl of beautiful chantilly cream. We've put some lovely sliced oranges on top of it for you. Dessert, enjoy. And you're like, yes, actually, yes. Because I just ate 3 pastas and a steak and I'm dying inside, and also 3 glasses of wine. This is fabulous. And the olive oil was so, that olive oil, whatever they're using is unbelievable. Yeah,
whatever fancy olive oil they're using is fantastic.
So good. So I think that simplicity of that dish is the same as all the other dishes, where it's just a simple, produce forward, technically proficient, lovely, delicate, beautiful. I think it's a great restaurant. I think it's a great place for a date night. One where you're like, you're not trying to go to the nines, but you want something special and intimate. You know, you really want to talk to the person you're with, which I think is important. Or, you know, if you want to just go out with a friend you haven't seen in a while, I think it's a really special place. I don't think it's necessarily special occasion only, but I think it just feels special. It's a really good intimate restaurant.
No. And in fact, like we ran into a couple that I know mm-hmm. who were just there on a date night, right? Their kids were either at summer camp or with their grandparents or whatever they were. And so they had mm-hmm. a night to themselves. They live in the area and they popped into Osteria Mercato for dinner. And I think you can do that very happily. And you don't have to get three pastas and two entrees and spend like we did. I mean, you can get one or two, right? You could get, you could get either the foie gras or the arancini plus the tuna, one or two pastas to share, and then split the steak and save a little room for dessert. Order a nice bottle of wine. You'll be out in that $150-ish range for mm-hmm. two people. And it will feel like a really special meal. It'll feel like a meal that you could have paid $250 or $300 for.
I think even if you wanted to go sit at the bar and have a glass of wine and just, you know, grab
just
a bowl
have the
of pasta.
Tuna, right? Right.
Just or have the pasta. Tuna. Just to have a pasta. Just have a pasta. Maybe treat yourself to the stagionale, the Chantilly dessert. I think you could do that and just have a quick little nightcap and go. Like, it really is one of those places where you can make it as big or as little as you want, because every dish is so good and so intentional that no matter what you're getting, I think you'll have a fabulous time.
And if you want to pregame it, you go to Maximo, you sit on the patio, you have a margarita, maybe a tostada.
Yeah.
Done and done.
I think great restaurant, great neighborhood, bang, bang, you know, go to Maximo, Maximo. Be like, hey, you guys want to try two of the best restaurants in Houston right now in West U? Nobody
that are a block
expects
from each other. I mean, like done and done.
Yeah. You walk off the tostada. You go get some pasta. You're done. It's great.
All right, Chelsea. I'm going to say that does it for the restaurant of the week. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much for listening. Join me on Thursday when my guest will be Fred McBride from Captain Mick's Seafood.